Now, I'm joined again today in studio by Dr. Lily Delaney. As you know, Lily Delaney is a general practitioner and she has a special interest in menopause. Last week, we talked about the sort of symptoms of menopause and about the sort of problems that menopause can cause for women. Today, we're going to go on to a little bit about the diagnosis and the management of menopause. And remember, if you can't listen to it today or if you have trouble sitting down or you're getting the dinner ready or whatever you're doing, you can always listen to it on the podcasts on the www.cry104fm website or on your smartphone. Lily, you're welcome today.
Thank you for having me back. Yes, we were going to talk about the diagnosis of the menopause.
We were. We went over the sort of symptoms and the myriad of symptoms that women can suffer. It makes me sort of feel that I'm glad I'm a man. I wouldn't say that in public, but I'm saying it on radio, mind you, so that's fairly public. But anyway, I am glad I'm a man. Let's talk about sort of you've seen a woman. She's sitting in front of you in the surgery and you've decided that she's perimenopausal. Where do we go from here?
So the lady is sitting in front of me in the surgery, and quite often she will mention this at the end of a consultation. She will have come in about something totally different, and after 10 or 15 minutes she'll say, by the way, I think I'm perimenopausal. And I would generally say that in order to be fair to the individual, because the diagnosis and treatment of the menopause must be individualised, because no two people experience it in the same way and no two people are treated in the same way, that in that scenario, I would ask her to return for a full menopause consultation. In that consultation, I would go through again the symptoms which suggest that she is perimenopausal. That would include, but it's not restricted by, her menstrual history, because as I mentioned already, you can be perimenopausal and still have regular periods. One of the myths that used to be held about HRT and the management and the menopause itself was that, oh, you couldn't be perimenopausal because you're still having regular periods. Well, that's a myth. So having gone through the history and established that, it's a diagnosis that you can actually make based on the history alone. You actually don't need to do blood tests. But nowadays we generally do, and what we would check the female hormones called FSH, which is follicle stimulating hormone, and we also check LH. We would check for thyroid disease, because underactive thyroid disease is common in women in their 40s and will present with many of the same symptoms. And indeed, we often detect overactive thyroid disease. We will check the blood pressure and make sure that there's no issue with that. If their blood pressure is elevated, we will assess, do a 24-hour blood pressure monitor. We go into some detail about the person's history. History of other illnesses, for example, clotting problems like DVT or pulmonary embolus in the past, history of gallbladder or liver disease, manage high blood pressure. It's not in itself a contraindication to having HRT if that's what we select in your management, but it must be managed. And then there's the thorny issue of, we would never prescribe HRT in somebody who has had breast cancer themselves, but if they have a family history of breast cancer, we will explore that in greater detail. And
can I just ask you, how strong does the family history have to be before you're going to be sort of saying, no, this is not an option for you?
Well, the genetically associated breast cancers are the BRCA gene, which we'll all be aware of. They're actually only about 5% of breast cancers. And if you consider that the baseline rate of breast cancer is 1 in 7, most of us, if we look backwards, we will have a family history of breast cancer. But you go into detail, you establish who had breast cancer. What type of breast cancer was it? Was there any further screening advice that this person have a positive BRCA gene? Apparently, if a male relative has breast cancer or had breast cancer, that is of great significance and may actually... what I generally do myself is, if I find somebody who has a complicated history of breast cancer, I will recommend one of the specialist breast clinics to them. And there are a few, there's more cropping up nationally now in the HSE and in private medicine. So it's accessible. But that's if there's a complicated family history of breast cancer.
And we'll say, what is, you know, HRT and breast cancer, as I say, when the first reports came out about breast cancer and HRT, as GPs, we ran a mile from HRT and now we're not running a mile anymore. What changed that for us?
First and foremost, it's not the estrogen in your HRT that causes breast cancer, it's the progesterone. And nowadays we're using body identical hormones for people. We seldom use the progestogens, which are chemically manufactured products. And so the body identical hormones, particularly the progesterone that we're using nowadays for HRT, has a very, very low impact on breast cancer risk. If you look at the overall health of the person, your lady who's sitting in front of you, or in the population in general, and you look at the effects of various different things on breast cancer risk, for example, being obese or having an increased body mass index or a BMI over 30 has a tenfold increase in risk of breast cancer. 2 glasses of wine a day has a threefold increase in breast cancer. And so oftentimes you will have somebody who is suffering menopausal symptoms in the perimenopause who has a BMI of 34 and who will happily drink 2 glasses of wine each day, each evening at home to deal with the misery and blot out the symptoms that she's suffering. But she wouldn't touch HRT. But she doesn't realise that what her obesity and her wine is actually increasing her breast cancer risk by far more than any form of HRT would do.
You're going to depress me now with this talk about having to cut down wine and having to cut down. I'm getting more unhappy happier that I'm a male all the time. But it probably has the same significance for males in other ways, you know.
Yes.
So we'll talk about HRT. For years, we were denying women HRT. And as I say, it's now back in vogue again. Now, we're not willy-nilly prescribing it, sure we're not?
We're not willy-nilly prescribing it, but because of the body identical forms that are available now and the fact that the transdermal delivery, that's through the skin by patch or gel for your estrogen, is much safer, we're much more ready to actually prescribe it and we feel much safer with it, acknowledging that transdermal or administering through the skin is not associated with any increased risk of clots. For example, somebody who doesn't have a uterus, who's on estrogen only HRT, doesn't increase her breast cancer risk. And if, you know, as I said, if you do a full and proper assessment and you manage the other healthcare issues, then HRT per se is not as much of a problem as it used to be. I often say to people, well, we're not extracting estrogen from pregnant mare's urine anymore. It's actually natural, it's vegetable source, and that's much safer and much more acceptable. I would encourage people, just as an aside, not to be dragged into the phenomenon of bioidentical. Very difficult concept. Body identical is what we go for.
Yeah, and what's the bioidentical?
Bioidentical is compounded. It's very expensive. It's accessible through various different clinics or whatever, but it's not regulated. There are no standardisation procedures associated with it, and it has no greater benefit than the types of HRT that we are prescribing nowadays. As I said, horse urine is no longer used to extract estrogen for HRT.
That's good to know. That's good to know. There's also sort of an awful lot of alternative type stuffs you read about or alternative stuff that women try to get wherever, whether online or whatever. Is there any evidence for much of that stuff?
I wouldn't totally dismiss them if they're used in conjunction with lifestyle measures like reducing weight, increasing exercise, reducing alcohol consumption. All of these things, they will all help in a holistic way towards improving the symptoms of menopause. But I would encourage anybody who thinks that they're in that space to come and talk to us.
Right, right. Have we anything else in the management now of HRT that we should be covering there?
Well, just I suppose to clarify the technicalities of the management, HRT is hormone replacement therapy. The main hormone we're missing in the perimenopause is estrogen, and that's part of every HRT package. If you have a uterus, you must have a progesterone to protect the uterine lining from the effects of the estrogen. If you are still having regular periods, you will be prescribed, that regime will be prescribed for you in what they call a cyclical HRT regime, where you will continue to have periods. You will have your estrogen on a continuous basis and the progesterone is added in for 12 days out of each month, and that allows for a continuation of periods. If you don't have a uterus, you will only need to have estrogen, and we are prescribing that by through the skin by gels or patches, which are very convenient, very easy to use. There is a supply issue with them at the moment, but our pharmacy friends are doing their level best to source them for people that we are prescribing them for. And I would almost exclusively prescribe gels or patches. If you have, if you're over 50 and you haven't had a period for 12 consecutive months, we will usually start you on what we call continuous combined HRT, which is a lower dose of your progesterone and your estrogen, and you take the same hormones every single day, and you shouldn't or wouldn't get a period if you are totally gone through that phase. Under 40 is a slightly trickier prospect, and we like to start women under 40 on cyclical combined HRT. Otherwise, you'll get a lot of unscheduled bleeding, and it's frustrating for the person, it's frustrating for you, and people end up maybe stopping their HRT because of bleeding. So again, it's individualised care, and we talk it through.
Okay, now last question for today would be, how long do you stay on your HRT for?
Well, the NICE guidelines, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, a bit of a tongue twister, say
yeah,
that...
Yeah, I always think of the biscuits when I think of...
The biscuits, yes, they're lovely. They say that there is out there, you don't ever have to stop using HRT. Okay, we would, you know, the research I do and the podcasts I have listened to, the GPs would talk about ladies in their 90s who are still having HRT. We have a window of opportunity. I suppose people will have heard about only having it for 5 years. That's a myth. People would hear about it not having to stop it when they turn 60. That is a myth. Starting it after 60 is still absolutely okay, but you may not get the same benefits as you would from starting it younger, but you don't increase your risk, okay? And generally speaking, we would try to start HRT within a 10-year window from the last period. But each individual woman who comes has an individual set of circumstances that we process before deciding to prescribe. And as one lecture I was at, she said that there are virtually no contraindications to HRT. There are situations where we have to be careful and take extra precautions and maybe get more expert advice, but it's something that should be discussed with everybody who wants to discuss it.
Okay, look, I think we'll leave it at that for today. Next week we might sort of review some of what we did this week, and we might talk about the treatment. We might talk about management in general, maybe possibly sort of the psychological symptoms and that sort of stuff too. But look, we'll leave that till next week. I'd like to thank Dr. Lily Delaney for that most informative talk. And I'm a man and I found it very informative.
Good.